Lecture 24, Truth, History, and Citizenship.
We've come a long way in this course, chronologically, from Plato's dialogue, The Sophist, and also conceptually, in attempting to expose the complexity of the concept scientific knowledge, of what it means when scientists claim to know nature, what the object of that knowledge is, what the justification for the claims that they have knowledge of nature are, and the complexity of the process that out of which scientific knowledge is produced. There are a number, I think, of core lessons that this historical approach to looking at the knowledge problem in science, as I've called it, has produced, and that need to be pulled together before we can reach any conclusions. First, and I think most essentially, the historicity of scientific knowledge, that science has a temporal character, not a once and done with a kind of truth, that you discover X, you put X in the bank, and now you move on to Y. A scientific theory is never once and done with. Science is intrinsically historical, or temporal, if you prefer that term, in the sense that it is continually changing at every level. It is changing at the level of data. It is changing at the level of instruments, as instruments are refined, for example, and in the process open up completely new data, or as totally new kinds of instruments are invented, which generate new kinds of data, so that science is continually changing at the level of data, at the level of physical instruments, at the level of the analytical tools, the conceptual instruments that are available to scientists at any given time. They too are continually changing, as, for example, new kinds of mathematical techniques are invented. We saw this in the rise of quantum theory, for example, where Heisenberg adapted an old technique in mathematics called matrix algebra, unknown to him. He sort of reinvented matrix algebra and used that as a tool to found his version of quantum mechanics. Einstein adopted a form of mathematics developed in the 19th century called tensor algebra, which becomes central to the compact description of the equations of the general theory of relativity. So as analytical tools change science, that also changes science. It allows us to have to see different things in theories when we formulate them in one way rather than another. The symbolic language that we use in science and mathematics, when it changes, tends to significantly change the kinds of research and the kinds of discoveries that are made by mathematicians and science. Science continually changes at the level of the assumptions that scientists use. The measures, as I like to call them, following Protagoras in this, that man is the measurer of all things, my own reading of Protagoras, that you must measure, you must begin with assumptions in order to reason, seems unexceptionable, but it is also the case that these assumptions change over time. We just saw that in terms of changing the definitions of space and time and matter and energy and changing what an atom is, changing what the universe is. So the science changes at the level of assumptions continually, and it changes at the level of that theories are continually changing. We've seen this over and over again. Theories also continually change. They develop and they evolve. They develop in the sense that they become more articulated, but they also change in ways that their founders did not expect, unpredictably. So Copernicus did not anticipate that one of his greatest disciples would be Johannes Kepler, who would switch the orbits from circular to elliptical, for example. Kepler did not anticipate that Newton would derive the ellipticity of the orbits from his theory of universal gravitation, and so on. So the elements of science, the data, the instruments, the conceptual assumptions and principles, the analytical tools, the theories are continually changing. That is, I think, manifest from the kind of inquiry that we've engaged in this course. That's why I adopted the historical approach because science is intrinsically historical. And you can only see that by following it unfold over history. So in one sense, at least, I am very sympathetic to Kuhn's notion that the history of science is the key to understanding the nature of scientific knowledge. But of course, as I have already mentioned in an earlier lecture, that is exactly what William Ewell claimed in the 1830s and 1840s, and which is why he wrote a two-volume work called The Philosophy of the Inductive Sciences, founded upon their history, that only through the changing fundamental ideas that scientists use from which to deduce phenomena could you recognize the logic of scientific reasoning. So only through its history does science display, so to speak, its inner character. These elements of science, the data, the instruments, the concepts, the principles, the theories, they change at different clock speeds, to borrow a term from the computer world. They change at different, the rate of change is different, of course, and they're different in different disciplines. It may be different in physics and different in chemistry, different in molecular biology than it is in than in geology. But all you have to do to see, blatantly see, the extent to which science changes at all of these levels that I've just described is to contrast the scientific knowledge claims that we make today with the scientific knowledge claims that we made in 1900. To contrast what we think is real today, what we think the Earth is today, the universe is today, what we think life is today, what we think human beings are today compared to what we thought they were, to what scientists claim we now know this about the universe. Well, in 1900, it was the Milky Way. We now know this about matter. That was before quantum theory. And we now know this about space-time. And so if you play that game out, you see that it's the difference between what scientists say they know now and what scientists said they knew then is startling. The reality that scientists tell us is out there is so totally different today from what it was in 1900. In fact, in most sciences, it's so totally different from what it was in 1960. Inflation of the universe did not exist before 1980. Dark matter didn't exist. Dark energy didn't exist. The quark theory of matter and energy did not exist before 1960. We don't need to press that point. In my opinion, brilliant and underappreciated British philosopher of science, Mary Hesse, in the third of her trilogy of deeply insightful books into the philosophy of science, makes the comment that we need always to keep in mind that the theories we currently believe to be true are just as falsifiable as the theories we look back on as having been falsified. And one might add, and the theories we currently hold to be true are as likely to be falsified in the next 100 years as the theories that we look back on as having been falsified in the last 100 years. So that is, I think, a fundamental insight that is extremely valuable in terms of assessing scientific knowledge and truth claims. Science remains the wonderful body of knowledge that it is, but it is understood to be an evolving body of knowledge keyed to assumptions that are themselves always conjectural and corrigible in ways that we've discussed. A second insight that I think we need to call attention to at the close of the course is that scientific knowledge is influenced by how scientific knowledge is produced, what scientists know, what they know, the content of their theories is also influenced by the process through which scientific knowledge is generated, and that is a fundamentally collective enterprise. Without buying into the rhetoric and the value judgments of the major proponents of the social construction of scientific knowledge, that theory of the social construction of scientific knowledge, it is quite clear, it seems quite clear, and Flex Monograph, I think, makes it inescapably clear that science is a collective enterprise. And the analogy with a language is very appropriate here. Scientists speak a language. The world of elementary particle physicists speak a language in talking about elementary particles. The evolutionary biologists speak a language in talking about evolutionary processes at whatever level they discuss them. Plate tectonic geologists speak a specific language about the Earth. and its structure and its, the forces that are acting on the Earth at various levels, especially the ones acting on the crustal plates, the continental plates and the ocean floor. Now we ask ourselves, do scientists invent the languages they speak, or do they discover them? Early in the course, I mentioned that Galileo had held that mathematics is the language of nature. He wrote, "The book of nature is written in the mathematical language, and its characters are circles, triangles, squares, etc., because geometry was the dominant modality of mathematical thinking at that time. It would soon be displaced by algebra." But what justification is there for saying that this language is the language of nature? Well, because Galileo had a metaphysical belief, which he called Platonic, but which was really Pythagorean, that nature is at its deepest level mathematical. And so that he believed, but he didn't know it, he believed that mathematics was the language of nature. But if we step back and say, well, in order to do science, then you speak a language, metaphorically speaking. Now, it doesn't matter English or French, but there is a language that you have to learn in order to be a relativity theorist, a quantum physicist, a chemist, a polymer chemist. Where did that language come from? Was the language invented? Well, that seems to support the historical view of science. Was the language found? You mean you just found? But if it's found, then it should be permanent. Why does it change? Why is there this temporal dimension to science? So we have, as a second point here, that science, the scientific enterprise that produces scientific knowledge, is a collective enterprise. Third point, going back to the very first lecture in the course, recognizing that the knowledge problem, that by which I mean the need to characterize what scientific knowledge is itself embedded in a wider knowledge problem within Western intellectual and cultural history, and that's the one between Plato and the Sophists, that we have from the side of Plato that the view of the gods, knowledge being universal, necessary, certain. Notice that on this view, scientific knowledge is not temporal. And Socrates carried this thing through in his moral reasoning. What is valuable, what is good, what is just, what is true, what is real, never changes. And then on the other side, the view of the Sophists that scientific knowledge has an experiential dimension, and as such, it is always contingent, it is always uncertain, and it is always concrete and particular. What we have seen in this course, and surely it did not escape your attention, is that over centuries, science has said to the question, well, which is it? Is it the gods or the earth giants? The answer of the scientific community has been yes. But what we want to hear is one or the other. And the science wants to have it both ways. We have repeatedly seen the inextricably realist character that is woven into the rhetoric of science, and at the same time, the parade of absolutely first-rate scientific thinkers who have insisted that science is not about an independently existing reality, that the focus of science is on experience, and who have accepted what I have been calling the temporality or historicity of scientific knowledge. And the community as a whole just smiles and says yes. Why is that? Why this ambivalence? One might even want to call it schizophrenia, however politically incorrect that might be. Why this ambivalence within the scientific community over what seems to be a clear choice in this great rationality battle between what Plato called the gods and the earth giants? If the object of scientific knowledge is experience, the earth giants win. If the object of scientific knowledge is reality with a capital R, that which exists behind and independently of experience and is eternal, then Plato's gods win. I think the answer is that experience itself, what we call experience, is concurrently the greatest warrant for realism and for the particular contingent and uncertain character of experience. Experience at one and the same time is literally about a world out there. That's the way we feel it. That's the way we experience. At the same time, all of our experiences are particular, contingent, and uncertain. There is an uncertainty associated with attempting to anticipate future experiences. All of our experiences are concrete and particular. You know, you don't encounter man with a capital M. You encounter this person and that person and that person. We don't experience necessity. We experience events that seem to be not connected to one another, and we're surprised by the order. We are often surprised by the order of events. As Hume pointed out, we never have an experience of necessity. Necessary connection is a concept, is an intellectual construct. So now, how are we to understand this aspect of experience? Well, first of all, notice from Plato's perspective, what you want to do is escape experience. Experience is hopelessly confusing, and experience wants to draw us into the particular, the contingent, and the uncertain. We need to achieve salvation. We need to escape experience and go behind it to the ultimate reality, which is timeless, eternal, like mathematical truth. Another view, the alternative view, it's not the alternative view, it's the one that seems to me to have the most promise for helping us to understand the situation, is John Dewey's view. You remember when I talked about Dewey, I said that for Dewey, mind and world are of experience, that they are not the names of things which confront one another in experience, but that they are of experience in the same way that a mountain is of the earth and the Grand Canyon is of the earth. It's not just a hole dug in the earth. The Grand Canyon is, as a phenomenon, is an expression of the earth and processes associated with the earth. And and Mount Everest is an expression. I called it an extrusion, which is probably geologically incorrect, but an expression of forces at work within the earth. It is the earth. Not just sitting on the earth as if somebody, a passing spaceship, dropped it down. Analogously, what we mean by the world and the mind, the realist position is of experience, and so is what we casually call experience, that is, say, our experience. That the words mind and world refer to processes that are of what we call experience. We tend to think of experience as something that's going on in here, and then we wonder what connection it has to what's out there. But Dewey's view was that experience is a name for that fundamental reality of which mind and world are names that we give to aspects of experience. And so from that perspective, science's ambivalence is quite natural. We can't really deny the realist position because it is a direct experience of ours. It is a direct experience that we're putting on our clothes. Nobody thinks that maybe I'm not putting on my clothes. Maybe it's just an illusion and there are no clothes. I said before, there is no car that you got into and you've turned the key in. So if we want to play a bit, not in a frivolous sense, but if we want to explore a bit the Deweyan position of how we can understand the nature of scientific knowledge as incorporating an intrinsic ambivalence, I called earlier an inner conflict, an internal conflict that manifests itself in the constant tension between the realist and the contingent, or let's call it conventionalist, just for casual purposes, conventionalist views of scientific knowledge, I'm going to make a suggestion that we introduce a word apart from reality and experience. I want to introduce the word actuality. The word real has deep connotations, especially when we talk about the real with sacred overtones. The real as the ultimate, because that's the way Plato and Aristotle and all Western philosophers have talked about it, that reality is unchanging. And even within science, those scientists who defend the realist view, believe that there are fundamental truths that the ultimate reality is unchanging. It's just that we no longer think that the ultimate reality is matter. The ultimate reality for those physicists are constants, universal constants of nature, and universal principles like certain kinds of invariance that are the fundamental principles of relativity theory and quantum theory, and therefore of our conceptions of matter and energy and their interaction. So we used to think, for example, of the conservation of matter as such an invariant. We have much more, there are much more sophisticated versions of that today. So at a certain level, even in contemporary physical science, there are certain eternal invariants. There are certain invariants that have been there ever since the universe started. And there has to be something constant. Otherwise, as I said in an earlier lecture, you can't reason. If everything about nature were changing all the time and there was no pattern that was constant, then you could not possibly reason about nature and you could not formulate scientific theories. So something has to be constant. If it's not the matter and the energy, then it's the principle by which matter gets transformed into energy and energy gets transformed into matter. And if it's not that equation, then it must be some equation deeper than that. And then that one stays the same so that the pattern of change is constant, or the pattern of the pattern of change is constant. But you must have some invariance. So on the one side, you've got reality has overtones of the ultimate, which are very disturbing because they have metaphysical implications, which get you into all kinds of logical and philosophical problems. So the relationship between ordinary experience and reality is very controversial and emotional. Let's substitute the word actuality and say that scientific theories are about actualities. What are actualities? Actualities are scientific objects. I've talked about that before. So the sun is a scientific object. The earth, we all know what the earth is in ordinary experience. And as a scientific object, the earth is defined by geologists. And that scientific, the characteristics of that scientific object change all the time. In 1806, Dalton started modern atomic theory by saying that atoms were like tiny little billiard balls, that they had no internal structure. In 1896, J.J. Thomson said that they do have an internal structure, so we had to redefine the atom so it had an internal structure, but it was still a continuous distribution of positively charged matter and tiny little dots of negative matter that were called electrons, analogous to raisins in a pudding, he said. Now, in 1910, 1911, Ernest Rutherford said, we have to redefine the atom, it's mostly empty space. Forget that bit about the positive charge. It's all concentrated in a tiny nucleus. 99% of the atom is empty space. In 1930, we had to say, oh, we thought that the matter was made out of electrons and protons. 1932, throw in the neutron. Now we have to redefine the atom so that the nucleus has no protons and neutrons. In 1935, we said, we've got to make room in the nucleus for mesons. By 1960, there were 200 elementary particles. By 1980, we were already saying, forget that whole business. It turns out that everything in the nucleus is made out of quarks. So the atom as a scientific object has been repeatedly redefined. And that's okay. It is much less controversial and difficult for us to grasp that scientific objects are redefined as we improve, as we get more experience, as we accumulate new data, we make new experiments, we have to redefine, we sharpen the definition or throw it out and start with a different definition. That's different from changing reality. Because our intuition is that what we mean by reality is something changeless. So if we recognize that scientific theories are about scientific actualities, fields and forces, particles and molecular structures, that's what scientific knowledge is about, and that those scientific objects are directly or indirectly correlated with ordinary experience. We're not interested in their connection with reality with a capital R. They're correlated with ordinary experience. Then the whole account of scientific knowledge that we've been tracing out in this course seems falls together very nicely. We understand, on the one hand, why there is a tendency, why there is a need, a psychological, let's call it a psychological need, and a philosophically justifiable need to claim that science is about more than mere experience, that these scientific objects have some connection with the real, but we don't need to deal with that. That's not really part of the scientific knowledge claims. The actualities are justifiable by a specifiable set of characteristics, namely, do they explain, do they give us predictive success, do they give us control? So we can judge actualities directly, whereas we can't judge reality directly. So seeing scientific knowledge as about actualities is a potentially useful way of eliminating much of the controversy from trying to understand the status of scientific knowledge and truth claims. At a minimum, scientific actualities, scientific objects, are justifiable instrumentally. What the implications of this instrumental success are for vis-a-vis reality is a separate issue. But here we have a quite explicit set of criteria, just as you can say, given what you want to do with a camera, this digital camera is better for you than that digital camera. So this definition of the atom is better than that definition of the atom because, and I can give you a list of reasons why. As stories about actualities, and I use stories in an honorific rather than a pejorative sense, as stories about actuality, actualities that work in these specifiable ways, then science is a source of truth in our society, but it is not the only source of truth in our society because other aspects of our lives, in other aspects of our lives, we tell stories about experience in different ways that don't involve scientific objects, that don't involve the actualities, as I have been calling them. But notice something interesting. For working scientists, these actualities are very real. If you are an elementary particle physicist whose whole career is spent doing experiments using the linear accelerator at Stanford University, those particles in there that you cannot see are real to you. They experience their actualities as the kinds of objects we experience in ordinary life. For them, the relationship between actualities and ordinary experience is a real phenomenon. It's reality for them. For us, outsiders to science, we have to take their word for it. Unless you want to play the game of science too, and you're quite willing, welcome to do that. So, this view of looking at scientific knowledge as having as its object actualities is eminently compatible with the view that scientific knowledge is always fallible and temporal. And that, I think, goes a long way, on the one hand, to seeing why there does not need to be a conflict between science and ordinary experience, and between science and religion, let's say. But at the same time, it also goes a long way towards helping us understand how scientific knowledge should be assessed when we want to make use of scientific knowledge. The deductive form of scientific knowledge obscures what I believe to be the fact, a fact about science, namely that it has this temporal and conjectural and corrigible character. So, finally then, here we are at the beginning of the 21st century, attempting to deal with profoundly concernful issues, such as global warming, stem cell research, genetic engineering, energy issues, policy, nanotechnology policy. What role can science play in this process? Scientists offer knowledge. To the extent that we misestimate the nature of that knowledge, we will have the wrong estimate of what scientists can do, to resolve these policy issues, which are, in the case of global warming, for example, quite controversial. There are disputes associated with the policy issue. To what extent can science resolve this? So let's note something that I think we have established beyond cavil in this course, that scientists cannot offer us certainty about experience. The deductive logical form of scientific knowledge can obscure that for a while, but we have certainly gotten behind that. There can be no certainty about experience, about the future. So scientists can all have theories about what will happen, but there are no guarantees that our current theories will accurately predict without failure what's going. So you can't turn to science for a guarantee about what's going to happen in the future. Second, the ethos of science, the code of conduct of science, rightly or wrongly, is that science does not incorporate value judgments relative to the use of scientific knowledge. So that you can't ask scientists as scientists to prioritize what the options you may find available to you based on scientific knowledge. The implications of this to me are very positive in a democratic society, because it creates a space for informed citizens to participate in policy in science and technology policy disputes of the most sophisticated kind without having to understand the technical issue involved. If we understand the kind of role that scientific and technical knowledge can play, we understand it as fallible and temporal and conjectural. But the best tool that we have for effective action on experience, then we have to use that kind of knowledge, understanding that the ultimate accountability for action is on us, not on the knowledge that the scientists claim to have. Because that knowledge is intrinsically probable, not certain. The accountability for action, as Aristotle had recognized, ultimately, action is non-rational. It cannot be deduced from anything you know, even if you were the wisest possible person. So action always requires that we use the best tools available to us, and science understood as having actualities, is scientific objects like the atmosphere, like the planet Earth, as its object, is the most effective tool we have for dealing with experience.
We genuinely hope you've enjoyed these lectures from our Great Courses series. Our courses are available to order online. Visit our website at www.teachone2.com or call our customer care representatives at 1-800-TEACH-1-2. That's 1-800-TEACH-1-2. Thank you very much.